thank you for the introduction. I'm really glad to be here. This is my first time at this type of event, so please interrupt. We can always ask questions. There's really no like payoff in various presentations, so we can always just have a dialogue as we go. But as you just heard, I want to talk a little bit about how we go about protecting companies from disinformation, or what disinformation looks like in an industry context, because we've probably heard a lot about it over the past year, and it comes down to this kind of basic idea. So I want to start with this because I know there's a lot of film and TV people here. Those of us who study this kind of thing, or those of us who've done this sort of research, or those of us who do this professionally, have a sense of, you know, so, like, I grew up thinking that Luke Skywalker was a hero, and kind of like a valiant defender of free people against like a terrible autocratic regime. But especially if you get into certain types of information security, typically around kind of counterterrorism, you really try and get into the frame of mind where you're trying to understand really difficult, uncomfortable, terrible points of view. You start to think about the world sort of like this. And you start to think to yourself, well, what's another way that we can imagine this? Like, maybe Luke Skywalker was sort of radicalized into an oddball ancient religion, and I guess you could say that after he was radicalized, he carried out a terrorist attack and he killed hundreds of thousands of people, which is terrible. And I'm sorry for ruining everybody's childhood. But the basic, the kind of key takeaway here is we're talking about disinformation online and its implications, is that the thing that we all believe is just social consensus. That's at the heart of this. But the reason that we all think Luke Skywalker's a hero is because that's our cultural narrative. But a different cultural narrative that we could have all grown up believing is that Luke Skywalker is a terrorist. And the whole point of this past year, or 2 years, or for some of us, 3 or 4 or 5 years, this huge focus on disinformation and its impact on our public discourse here in the US and around the world is about manipulating that social consensus. Is the world really how we see it? Or have we been fooled into seeing it in a particular type of way because of how we've been consuming information from accounts and people and news sources and whoever, sort of trusted sources of information online? Has our perception been changed? And of course, in this conversation, we've been talking largely about Russia, Russian disinformation, because it's been about largely our US public discourse around policy issues and our elections in particular. But this is not new. So back in 2014, 2013, some of us started looking at the way that other types of manipulative content was being spread on social media. We were looking at terrorist organizations like ISIS. If you remember when ISIS just dominated American news cycles, like week in and week out, everything was about ISIS all of the time. And what was interesting about that, as somebody who's interested in how information spreads across social media, was that there weren't very many people who supported ISIS in the abstract. Thousands of people, countries away. Like, the risk of any of us getting killed in a terrorist attack here in the US is tiny. Tiny, tiny, you're much more likely to be hit by a car, you're going to die in a plane crash, you're going to get struck by lightning, you're not going to be killed by a terrorist. Nevertheless, it dominated our media, and we wondered, how is it possible that they were able to do that? How is it possible that they were able to radicalize people who then consumed this information online, got kind of sucked into these, like, sort of homogenous, hyperactive, super-focused, extremist information spaces, and then ended up being so passionate about this kind of obscene cause that they would travel to a different country to participate in somebody else's war. How is that possible? And it looks a lot like this. Small numbers of hyperactive accounts that pose as real people, that can coordinate their activity to give you the impression of social consensus. So if I can control 10,000 social media accounts, and they all say what I want them to say, then to you as an outsider, it looks like 10,000 people believe the same thing, which is a much stronger signal than just me saying it to you alone. This is the type of manipulative social consensus that we were interested in, or that we thought was going on as we looked into disinformation in 2016. Because there's nothing special about ISIS. They're not magic. They weren't able to manipulate our public discourse because of some special sauce about the way that they communicated, just like Russia isn't magic. They weren't able to sow discord in our elections. They weren't able to manipulate our online communities. They weren't able to potentially undermine our election process because they're special. They just knew which vulnerabilities to exploit. They're thinking about this like a systems problem. They're thinking about this like almost like a network security problem. Like we're talking about almost like cognitive penetration testing, then it's possible, because so much of what we've grown to accept about social media is in fact not what it seems. Tens of millions of Facebook accounts that are fake, that's reported by Facebook, by the way, so you can assume that number is remarkably conservative. Tens of millions of Twitter accounts, and tens of billions of dollars have been spent on propaganda that's targeting industry. And so we're going to talk a little bit more about Russian propaganda, but I want to bring it back to industry, obviously, because of the focus here. I'm sure everybody's interested academically in kind of the impact on our public discourse by state disinformation, state-sponsored disinformation, but we'll bring it back into the main. So the way that we think about this problem is that it's a combination of digital media, machine learning, and national security. There's a security component to it. There's obviously a signals development or machine learning component to it, because this is a computational problem. But it's also digital media. You have to understand how information moves online. So, sticking with Russia for a second, we started 2.5 years ago looking at domestic extremism, right? Because I have a counterterrorism background as a researcher. So we started seeing activity online that looked a lot like terrorism, a lot like the way that ISIS was able to manipulate public discourse. And we thought, this would be really bad. If the same phenomenon that ISIS was able, or the same kind of vulnerabilities that ISIS was able to exploit, were being exploited by domestic radicalized groups, that's much more dangerous to Americans. And so we started pulling information online. We looked for obvious examples of extremism by looking for, you know, people who obviously identify as extremists. If you're posting like swastikas in your Twitter profile, you're a bad person. Other signs that you're a bad person, it turns out, if you mention your race in your Twitter profile and you're white, bad person. I can say that pretty conclusively at this point. So we started looking into this extremist content, people that were posting text and images to divide Americans on very socially divisive issues and taking really extremist defensive positions. And we started to measure their language. We started to use machine learning to understand how their language was measurably different, quantifiably different from the mainstream. And so if we took a word that would obviously be different, if you're talking about a white nationalist community, for example, and we said, how do they talk about the word, how do they use the word Jewish? And most of us use the word Jewish in the same way that we use the word Christian, or use the word Muslim, or use the word whatever, because it's a religious descriptor for most of us. But if you're an extremist, this kind of far right, you know, the kind of extremists that Russian accounts were imitating in order to divide Americans, you use the word Jewish really differently. You use it like an epithet. So while the word Jewish is basically synonymous to the word Christian in everyday language in the way that we understand it, in the extremist community, the word Jewish is similar to communist or homosexual or leftist. It's an epithet. So they use the word very differently. We can measure this signal. We can measure this difference. And we started to look at how this difference, how this language usage was changing in online communities over the course of 2016. So in this period of time, when there was an intense amount of activity from these Russian-linked troll accounts spreading propaganda in order to sow discord in the US, we looked to see that measurable signal that we found, that difference between everyday Americans and extremists, can we see it in action? And so we looked on Twitter, we published this article in the Washington Post, and there was a dramatic shift in the language of Americans to go from the mainstream to more extremist, especially in the spring and summer of 2016. Then we looked at Facebook, same phenomenon. Mainstream language that takes a dramatic shift to be more extremist in the spring and summer of 2016. Then we started looking at web forums and other kind of slightly off-brand, less mainstream websites like Reddit. Same phenomenon. So across multiple online platforms, hundreds of millions of users, billions of posts, we were starting to see a pattern that was occurring everywhere that Americans were online. And we thought to ourselves, this is a little bit weird, because either we're heading for Civil War number two, which, I mean, you never know, but it seemed more likely that what was going on was some type of coordinated manipulation targeting multiple online platforms at the same time. And to have the resources and the ability to orchestrate a campaign on that scale, you need to be massive. You're probably not some kid screwing around, you're not the proverbial 400-pound fat guy in his mom's basement, you're probably a state actor like a government, and given the intention, you're probably a hostile state actor like Russia. So we use these techniques to discover propaganda as it was sort of infecting our public discourse in 2016, but it's not just politics, and this is why I want to bring it back to industry. So, in addition to undermining our election process, we found evidence of propaganda that was targeting industry as well. So there's a campaign that was actually just recently publicly documented by the U.S. House of Representatives attacking the energy industry. And so this is kind of an interesting thought experiment. Who in this room has heard about fracking? Everybody, right? This is really odd, because normally everyday people aren't familiar with the kind of ins and outs and specifics of techniques for energy extraction. how do we extract energy from the ground? There are lots of ways to do it. Why are we also familiar with fracking? Because, and this is not to dispute the scientific veracity of the potential environmental concerns around fracking, but there was a $10 million propaganda campaign also paid for by Russian troll farms in order to amplify the research and discontent and concern around this particular technique for extracting energy from the ground. And so here, another state-sponsored campaign. So this is a Russian-backed effort to undermine domestic energy production in the U.S. So again, targeting industry instead of electoral politics. But it's not just industry. It's also finance. So just recently, a few economists in the U.K. released some research showing that they looked at millions of Twitter accounts posting over a three-year period, and automated Twitter accounts, so bots, when they can coordinate their activity to depress a stock price for 30 to 40 minutes at a time and increase the volatility of that stock price for days at a time. So eventually the stock price course corrects, that's why it hasn't been a huge story, but anybody who knew that they could accomplish that could effectively short a stock on purpose, they could depress the price of the stock, get it out of the bargain, and then just wait for the market to course correct. And in an hour and a half, in our attempt to replicate this research, we found a number of examples of social media accounts that were intentionally saying negative things about individual stock prices, individual stock tickers. And what's interesting is that they weren't even pretending to be to targeting other human beings. So this Twitter account that I pulled out right here had a total of 24 followers on Twitter. No human being is following that. It's specifically designed to target the kind of automated listening systems, the social listening systems that large companies or kind of large stock traders use to get a sense of the kind of social sentiment around a particular stock or stock price and try and make a guess about the direction that's going to go. So they're using computational techniques to infect our systems in order to manipulate the way that particular industry behaves. So in addition to electoral politics, we have finance, we have energy, and then, of course, we have the media. So what's interesting here is that I think most of us in this room, in some way, interact with this sort of uniquely cultural product. And while the focus has been largely political around Russian disinformation in the 2016 elections, what's often overlooked is that they were also they weighed in on gun rights and gun control. They weighed in on issues regarding race and immigration. These kind of highly polarizing issues for Americans, they were taking extreme positions in order to sow divisions in our public discourse and make it difficult for us to communicate with one another. This is on the back of a kind of sort of rising sort of specific strain of populism born on internet kind of web forums of 4chan and 8chan, places where most of us don't go and hang out. I wouldn't recommend going to either of those websites while you're at work. He knows. but these online communities are very active. They're very hyperactive. They're very opinionated. And they have an ideological perspective that they'd like to see sort of propagated throughout the world. And so if you remember the Ghostbusters movie, the kind of all-female version of the Ghostbusters movie, the online conversation around that movie was not about the quality of the film. It was not about whether or not it was a sort of a fun family comedy. It wasn't about whether or not they were kind of doing the series justice. The conversation around that movie was whether or not Hollywood, full of social justice warriors, was fighting the sort of the PC, the politically correct obsession, casting women in the lead roles, and whether they ruined everybody's childhood because of their obsession with being social justice warriors. That was the online conversation, and it was totally manufactured. We found evidence of groups of accounts on anonymous web forums like 4chan literally planning this type of attack on the film, talking about how they were going to collaborate, describing the hashtags that they were going to use when they pushed the account, when they pushed the campaign over to Twitter, talking about the narratives that they wanted to develop, talking about the ways that they wanted to describe the movie to make it, to undermine it as effectively as possible. And then tens of thousands of fake accounts, perhaps operated by the same people who were describing the campaign or paid for it, because it's trivial to spend hundreds of dollars in Bitcoin and amplify whatever message you want, in kind of like social media gray markets where you can engage in constant arbitrage, and they pushed the campaign to undermine the film. More recently, I don't know if you sort of caught wind of the Netflix boycott. There was a rumor that former President Obama was going to produce a TV show or a program for Netflix, and then of course, Twitter was talking about changing their board, bringing on some members of the Obama administration on the board. And then there was an immediate backlash where dozens of Twitter accounts posting in high volume, amplifying this boycott Netflix hashtag in response to this news. No way human beings could post as often and as consistently as the accounts that we were finding that were describing, sort of advocating for this boycott. But they were directly targeting a company and sort of using, in addition to directly targeting the company, they were also directly targeting other conservative hashtags, which is kind of interesting. So presumably, they could target the company based on the fact that they were having high profile associations with Democrats or former Democrats. And so they would pick other popular conservative hashtags. Hashtag MAGA, M-A-G-A, Make America Great Again. Hashtag 2A, which stands for Second Amendment. There are hashtag other things that have nothing to do with Netflix or conservatism, like Passover, Thursday Thoughts. And they were using these hashtags in their tweets in order to sort of push their content in front of people who were already interested in those conservative issues or conservative talking points. And then they would append boycott Netflix. So anybody who was just generally interested in Second Amendment rights, hanging out on social media, would also get introduced to this idea of boycotting Netflix because of its association with former Democrats. So a very targeted, high-volume campaign to undermine the brand. And then...
How did that all work out?
It's still working out. That campaign is still active. So...
And is Netflix aware that you are a campaign?
I think that they are, but I'm not sure who all at Netflix has read the email that we sent them. As of yet, I'm clear.
And what would you advise a company to do in that situation? In your email, you probably gave them some ideas of what to do.
Oh, yeah. So we have lots of emails about what to do. There's a whole section. And I lied. There is a payoff at the end of the presentation. It's all the what to do part. So it's a good question. Like, what do you do when you discover this type of activity? Because it happens remarkably frequently. I think this is paramount.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. It's producing a kind of a Heather spinoff. It's like a twist on the original, where the kind of like I don't know, alternative kids of the Heathers and their. If you there's way too much context here.
Yeah,
if you haven't seen the original Heathers, I'm sorry. It's important to understand. But so there's a new Heathers that's come out, or that is about to come out, and it's been targeted by the same group of users. And so it's interesting that in this case it's been targeted by people on both sides, I guess, like for it and against it. Some people are upset because they don't like the way that the characters have been recast. Some people say that they're upset because it's not true to the original. Some people say that it's pandering to the alt-right, which is not an accusation against Paramount. That's how it's characterized on kind of alt-right web forums. But you can see here that they're saying that look, in these posts, that we discovered, they're talking about how they're going to dislike the movie on YouTube, that they're going to downvote the movie, the trailer, excuse me, they're going to downvote the trailer en masse on YouTube so that everybody else who comes to see that trailer from whatever, wherever they discover it, sees that it's been downvoted at high volume, that like thousands and thousands and thousands of people dislike this YouTube trailer. But do they really? They're trying to give you the impression that there's a huge volume of people who dislike the trailer. And as a film studio, I can imagine this being, or as any production company, incredibly difficult to understand whether or not the public is reacting. Because this happens. Sometimes you make something that isn't good. Or sometimes you make something that's just out of touch with what people want to consume, and there's a backlash. I'm sure that that happens in legitimate ways all the time. Well, hopefully not all the time, but it must happen occasionally. But how do you know the difference between that and this type of coordinated campaign where tens of thousands of users, where you can drive tens of thousands of people to go take the same coordinated action, or you can pay for that coordinated action with a few hundred dollars in Bitcoin? Like, you can download, you can pay for thousands of people to go download a trailer on YouTube within minutes if you know the right Bitcoin wallet to deposit money into and the right kind of sort of black hat forums to hang out in and request for that type of service. We saw there was a petition basically sort of demanding that the Paramount reject their sort of shelve the production and not produce the TV show. And we saw that popping up on random Instagram channels that weren't in English. We saw it popping up on people were referring to the petition in the link of a Pakistani YouTube service, like a YouTube clone that's popular in Pakistan, where I assume Heather's is not popular. Or well understood. Nevertheless, this is where the link was being dropped so that random people would discover it and they could send additional traffic to signals online that would give the public the impression that there was a sort of groundswell of backlash against this particular title. Okay, doing something about it. The payoff. So, we think about this primarily as getting out in front of the problem because, like, two things. One, being able to distinguish between legitimate public backlash. Like if you're United and you pull somebody off of an airplane, there's a legitimate public backlash, presumably, to the action that you took. That damage to your brand is kind of your own fault. But let's pretend that that video was manufactured. What if a couple college kids shot that in their dorm room, or whatever, they shot it in some building on campus. They imitated a United plane. They imitated the whole thing. And then they published it online, and they paid for it to be amplified by 10,000 Twitter accounts and 50,000 Facebook followers. Who could know the difference? How long would it take to know the difference? How much damage would be done to your brand in the meantime because of this computational information attack? So distinguishing between actual organic backlash and manufactured backlash is step one, and getting out in front of the problem so that you have 24, 48 hours a week's notice so that when the campaign does come, you've already thought about how you'd like to play it. You've already inoculated your customers against the narrative, the way in which they might be manipulated. So we think the first step is actual threat hunting. In the same way that threat hunting has become kind of a common tool in proactive network security, proactive cybersecurity, understanding where bad actors are, discussing their bad activities, being in those forums, having a legitimate presence in places where people are talking about pirated content, having a kind of an authentic presence where you've infiltrated communities where people are trading secrets, trading hacking tools, things like that. That type of threat hunting is almost identical in this space. Infiltrating communities where these types of campaigns are being coordinated because they're coordinated in the open. This type of collaboration is planned and discussed in communities that are possible to infiltrate online. Once you're in, then we can use technology and machine learning, or we can use technology to consume the data in these spaces, consume the language, consume the information that's being posted in these spaces, and we can use machine learning to get a sense of when there's anomalous changes in activity. When is there a hyper-focus on a particular topic? When are communities of users or groups of users planning their activity or coordinating their activity and focused on a single set of words or ideas or phrases or URLs or whatever? And we can get alerted to that activity so that we can consume tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of documents at a time and get a sense about when these types of attacks are being planned so that you can get some advance warning. And then lastly, once you have advance warning, then you can do something about the problem. You can get out in front of it in a few different ways. So we have examples of customers working with press, communicating directly with friendly publications and telling them our audience is going to be attacked by a bunch of racists who want people to believe that going to see a particular film of ours in the theater is dangerous, that they're going to get attacked. And you can get out in front of that narrative by talking to press, who will then tell everybody that this sort of fake news will be directed at them, so that as soon as they see it, they recognize it for what it is. They're not fooled, they don't question it, they don't go, oh, maybe I shouldn't go to the movie because now I've seen this social media post that looks plausible to me. They go, oh no, I've been told about that already. I read about that in Variety. It's just a bunch of racists. And so you've inoculated them and you've manipulated the narrative. You can also build relationships directly with the platforms, particularly in the aftermath of the YouTube shooting recently. We had a lot of success identifying accounts that were amplifying kind of conspiracy theory narratives that wasn't really happening. Every time there's kind of a major tragedy like this, there's various kind of conspiracy theory organizations that promote the idea that it was a false flag, didn't really happen, the shooting is a fake, for whatever reason. The idea that YouTube was attacked by it, it's a fake news story being promoted by people who want to use it as an excuse for advocate for gun rights. That's sort of a popular narrative. And so in the aftermath of the shooting at YouTube, we worked with the social media companies, identified accounts that were promoting these sort of false flag conspiracy theories at high volume, that were automating their activity and behaving as bots, and we got those accounts taken down. So this is activity that most of the platforms don't want. They've come out against it. They don't want people misrepresenting themselves with fake accounts. They don't want people engaging in unattributed large-scale automation or coordination. It's manipulative, they're getting a ton of bad press about it, and they are willing to take action. So once you've identified it, you can work with the platforms to stem the activity before it gets out of hand. And then lastly, I think specific to this audience, I guess, or sort of an entertainment industry-specific threat vector has been the review websites. So we've had a number of examples already of people coordinating their activity to effectively tank the audience score on Rotten Tomatoes, IMDb, Metacritic, and others. Sometimes brazenly, there was a public Facebook page that took credit for orchestrating a campaign against the recent film. Bragged about buying fake Facebook accounts, and it was easy to find. If you look at all the reviews of the audience reviews associated with that movie, you could find the corresponding Facebook account that they used to sign up to write the review. The account had already been blocked by Facebook in many cases because they don't let you maintain a fake Facebook account for very long. They're pretty good at recognizing those. So, block fake accounts, use them to log in, registered for Rotten Tomatoes profile, left a terrible review about a movie, gave it 1 star, and then disappeared. And if you do that tens of thousands of times, or even as thousands of times, you can have a huge delta between the critic score and the audience score. And it doesn't matter that the individual audience reviews look fake. It doesn't really matter that the comments don't seem consistent, because all everybody else does, everybody who's not obsessed with trying to understand the type of manipulative activity, does a drive-by. They go to the Rotten Tomatoes page, they see the critic score, they see the audience score, and they go, oh, maybe it's not that good. And some film studios have told us that they estimate tens of millions of dollars in lost box office revenue just from depressed interest in the film based on this kind of social media manipulation. So we've been working with at least the IMDb and Rotten Tomatoes, and when we identify this type of activity, either coordinated attacks on the movie to depress the score, or sort of ideological attacks on the movie, racist trolling, that kind of thing, to get out in front of it, let them know that it's occurring on their platform, and they've been very receptive to moderating that activity. So, Those are the kind of straightforward vanilla, I think, responses to this sort of problem. As long as you know that you're being attacked and you know in advance that the campaign's going to occur, you can inoculate your audience against the threat of using the press, you can work with the platforms to take down the accounts, and you can work with the review platforms to make sure that they are only allowing legitimate activity on their platform so it doesn't undermine your brand or your property. So those are all kind of technology-based solutions. So we see this as a long-term problem. But I think the kind of inciting incident, perhaps, for why the sort of Russian disinformation story has gotten so much attention, or why it was so effective in undermining something as large and as complicated and as robust as a Western democracy's national elections, are that most people get most of their information online, at least in the West. That's been very recent. That more than half of the population gets more than half of their news online. So because of this shift, we're in this for the long haul. Kind of information warfare, these targets of opportunity are everywhere. We haven't really thought about our information ecosystem as mindset before. We haven't thought about it like a system security problem before. We haven't thought about computational propaganda before. And so there now, after multiple years of pressure, we've been pressuring Facebook about Russian disinformation for 2 years. We've been pressuring them about ISIS disinformation for 2 or 3 years before that. They're finally acknowledging that there's a problem they need to address. So to make sure that they address it in the right way, because they are effectively the gatekeepers to our information ecosystem, I encourage communities like this to use your voice, use your collective voice, to advocate for the type of relationship you'd like to have with those social media platforms, because they're listening now. Now that they're getting hauled in front of Congress, now that they're worried about getting legislated, they're very open to conversations so that they could take care of this without going through policymakers in the U.S. government. And of course, legislation is another option. If you have any interest in policy, I do think there's a path to start to regulate the way that information moves across these platforms in the same way that we regulate public television and other kind of broadcast medium. And then I think we should prepare for the next generation of these types of technologies. Right now, the way that communities are being attacked is at a very high level, at the community level. They're targeting tens of thousands of users at a time. But what we'll see soon is technology that's much more sophisticated, that can interact with your individual social media behavior and can target you individually and talk to you specifically about the whatever sort of persuasive influence, whatever the objective is of the attackers. They can do it at a much more micro level. And they'll be able to do it not just with generated text, generated images, generated video. And so it looks a lot like spear phishing attacks. It looks a lot like me grabbing little bits of information that I can find based on your Twitter and Facebook and wherever, whatever presence, and sending you an email that looks incredibly personalized to fool you into taking some action that I want you to take. And so I think as we think about kind of phishing and spear phishing and kind of individual protection, and we think about this kind of information protection, I think we'll see a blend of those two things over the next probably 5 years. There we are. I'll be around for the next couple hours. Thank you very much for the time. Thank you very much for having me. And looking forward to hearing the rest of the presentations today.